5 of them together, and he closed that 5, and he got 7.5 million pounds of thrust out of this thing, and shot 3 people to the moon like it was nobody's business. Back to you, there.
The Elon Musk mission, where 2 people who know each other are going to make this loop around the moon. I got about 2 or 3 questions here. 1, I think it takes close to 3 days to get to the moon, loop around, another 3 days to come back. Sounds like a 6 or 7 day mission. It sounds like they're not going to do a retro burn on the backside of the moon. They're not going to go into lunar orbit. And it's going to be, I'm guessing, a figure 8 around the moon. In other words, they aim to the left-hand side of the moon from our point of view, whip around toward the right on the backside of the moon, and then come back to Earth. So it's a huge figure 8 in space. How soon is that mission going to take place, Paul? Is that projected for the end of 2018, so to speak? And along those lines, has he even dreamed about doing a deorbit burn so he stays in the lunar orbit for a little while, and or possible lunar landing? WS2N, K2LAW.
No, not at this time. You know, if this goes good, probably years down the road, you know, you could develop stuff like that. But right now it's just planned on doing, like you said, a figure eight coming back. And that was always the out for all the Apollo flights. You know, if you had a problem, you could always do a figure eight a return. It would be a self-return flight. And pretty much Apollo 13 pretty much followed that pattern. You know, they were in big trouble. You know, they did not go into orbit around the moon. And the same with Apollo 8. Apollo 8 did not go around. Did not go into. They did go around orbit around the moon. But if it failed, they had plans on having a free return. So that was the out on all of the flights, I believe, except Apollo 17. For some reason, they said that would not work. But they had enough confidence with it; they wouldn't have a problem. So, by the way, I mentioned Jeff Bezos with the New Glenn. That should be 2020. And here's the optimistic part that I dropped. I'm losing my train of thought. Elon Musk, always very optimistic. The Falcon 9 Heavy, three of them going up at one time, probably later this year. It was first scheduled to be launched in 2013, so we're already 4 years behind. You know, eventually he gets these things done, but he makes these predictions, but you find yourself years later. Sometimes he has to cancel one idea. He had plans on testing the Dragon propulsive landing system out in the desert probably 3 or 4 years ago, and that's on hold. You know, he wants to take a Dragon spacecraft just with the propulsive rockets that are, you know, they're inside of the spacecraft, and use them to take off from the ground out in that would be Texas, you know, Waco, Texas. And he wants to take off and then come back and land over and over, again. He would like to do that testing. I think someday that will be done, but called the Dragonfly system. So, you know, it is what it is. You know, you make predictions and sometimes you make it, but most of the times you don't.
So once again, Paul, the 2 people who know each other on this Falcon 9 Heavy, I think it is, are going to go around the moon. Is that launch scheduled for the end of 2018? And has he lined up more than 2 people? Are there other people ready to sign on the dotted line to go on flight number 2, 3, and 4? Over to you, Paul.
Says that there would be many people that are willing to do this, but at the end of 2018. Now, a year ago or so, he made a prediction he was going to land a a Dragon crewed vehicle without any people on Mars in 2018. And that didn't work out. That's out the window now. Now he shifted that to 2020. So, you know, already there's delays. But it's not only him. You know, NASA and a lot of people make predictions. Boeing was supposed to have their Starliner up and flying by now. And, you know, in that industry, it's a very risky industry. A lot of things have to be tested, retested. And these predictions are always, not always, most of the times they're pretty far off. End of 2018, Dick. And all three boosters are going to come back and land on land. Check that out, by the way. Instead of one landing back on land, he's going to have three land at the same time. Back to you.
The three boosters, these are the ones that are propelling it to go to a trans-Earth lunar orbit. All those boosters are going to come back and land.
Wow.
And that's the end of 2018. That's the first flight, figure eight, around the moon. Is it roughly a 6 or 7 day mission? And has he started collecting names for the people that are going to be flight number two and flight number three, Paul, T2RIW?
I don't know about that. He said there would be other people. He believes there would be many people that would line up to do this. So, the three boosters are going to come back to land. By the way, he took over another launch complex. It was called Launch Complex 13 in Florida. And he cleared it out, put a big circle around, and put an X in the middle for a SpaceX. And he called that Landing Zone 1. So Landing Zone 1 is where two rockets so far have come back. Wait, no, correction, three rockets have come back successfully and landed there. Two night flights and one day flight. So near Launch Complex 13, very close to that same location. He's going to put two more circles. So you're going to see two boosters come back, and then eventually the third will come back. So I saw the interviewing Gwen Shotwell. She's the president of SpaceX. You know, she was on the dais with the NASA people, and those people were asking questions, and they said, are all three going to come? Booth is going to come back? She said, all three are coming back. Back to you, Dick.
Does that mean when they do that loop around the moon, there'll be no boosters left? They'll have no thrusting capability at all?
It'd be similar to what they have now. Right now you have Falcon 9. Nine engines. It goes up, Falcon 9 booster comes back, lands successfully 8 times so far. The second stage has another one of those engines. All the Falcon 9 engines, each of the 9 engines is called a Merlin. And they're up to Merlin D. They had a Merlin A, they skipped B, and they went to C. Now they have a Merlin D engine. So there's 9 of these things. Well, they have another one, another Merlin D, in the second stage. And that's what brings them, into further orbit. And then it's a little different design. It's meant to operate in a vacuum, but it's basically the same engine. That's what they use for the second stage. The same thing with the heavy. The three boosters will come back, and then now you're into the same second stage with the one engine. Sorry, and by the way, we have the first reusable booster going up. That's about launching, coming up on the 27th of this month, again from Launch Complex 39A. Again, he's a little optimistic. I think it might be delayed to the beginning of April, but it's scheduled for the 27th. It's going to be the first reuse of a booster, one of those 8 boosters that came back. They're going to send up a satellite to geosynchronous orbit with that thing. And that one's going to come back and land on a barge. Back to you, Dick.
What makes them decide to land on the barge versus land on Cape Canaveral? I guess it's a function of how far downrange that particular booster is being used. So to bring it all the way back to Florida is a lot more energy required than landing on a barge that's out in the Atlantic. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, he has two big barges now, one out in the Pacific, which was used once so far successfully. And then he's got another one here on the East Coast. And, yeah, if you're doing a geosynchronous flight, you're going to need a lot more fuel push to get that thing to where it's got to go. By that time, your booster is way too far offshore to have enough fuel to come back to Cape Canaveral. So he lands it on a barge 400 miles, and I'm not kidding, 400 miles out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. You know, if it's, let's say, a flight to the space station, that's low Earth orbit, 250 miles up. You have now enough fuel in that boost to turn around, do a boost back, and come all the way back to Cape Canaveral. And that's what he's done three times. Back to Cape.
Boy, that's impressive. Amazing. No talk about lunar orbit injection. No talk about lunar landing at this time on any of these guys. Is that true, Paul? K2RIW?
No, not at this time. Nope. The only chance you got there now is if the United States and now, you know, when NASA decides to start making flights to the moon instead of Mars, starts pouring money into a lander, that would be the only chance. I mean, Russia has long-term plans. India, they do, and so does China. But, you know, these things are far off. I mean, we do have lunar landing things coming up probably at the end of 2017. There's a couple of launches, you know, unmanned, of course, trying to win the Google Prize. So you might see some landings, but nothing manned yet to expect yet.
Have they backed off on these substance recovery missions? In other words, at one time there was talk about going to an asteroid and doing some mining, going to the moon and do some mining. I'd like to believe that when they finally thought more clearly about that, it's not economically viable. The price of getting a rocket to these celestial objects is so expensive. I don't care if what you're recovering is platinum, gold, uranium, whatever. I don't think it's an economically viable thing to do. Is anybody continuing to talk about mining operations on any celestial object? WS2N, K2IW?
There is one company that is involved with developing things like that. I'm trying to think of the name of it. Planet Resource or something. I'll think of it. But they haven't had a flight yet. And if they have a flight, they don't have a rocket. They have equipment that would be put on a rocket. The closest thing to it was what NASA was planning. I think that's going to be canceled. Something called the ARM project, ARM. I'm not a big fan of this thing, but it was called the Asteroid Redirect Mission, ARM. And they've been planning it for quite a few years, pouring some money into it. And they were going to go out to an asteroid and go very close to the, not land, but go to it and pick up a boulder. I mean, something that, you know, might be 30 feet in diameter or more. Pick it up with, you know, big, there's like three radio towers sticking off the end of it. And it was, grab the boulder and then fly it away from the main asteroid and bring it back to the moon and put it in orbit around the moon. So this is the ARM mission, Asteroid Redirect Mission. Now, to do that, you needed an SLS launch, a space launch system, which hasn't flown yet. It's supposed to fly at the end of 2018. SLS would go out and send the satellite out, grab this boulder, bring it back, put it in orbit around the moon. Now it's flying in orbit around the moon. Take two people, put them in the Orion spacecraft on top of the space launch system when we drop it. fly them out to the moon and go into orbit around the moon, dock with this thing, you know, do an EVA, leave your spacecraft, start chipping away at this boulder, 30-foot boulder, and bring pieces back into the Orion spacecraft, undock with it, and fly back to Earth. This was not only to find out, you know, scientifically what this rock is made out of, and it's to show the capabilities that they have to it's kind of like a test run, a proof of concept of being able to do this kind of thing, because they eventually want to do this type of thing going to Mars. You know, you've got to be able to do EVAs, and maybe you'll want to, you know, land on Phobos or Deimos, you know, one of the two moons of Mars before you, you know, before you actually go down and land on Mars. So this is, I mean, they were pouring money into this idea, and I think it was going to get canceled. Let me drop it. I thought it was going to get canceled, no matter who won the election, by the way. You know, it was having some second thoughts by a lot of people in the space community. Yeah, it's pretty much dead now, of course. Back to you there.
Virgin Atlantic, he wants to fly people to space. Where does he stand, Paul? I think his definition of space is what, altitude of 50 kilometers or greater. And I thought for a while he had a whole lot of people lined up to take those very brief flights. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, the common line, 100 kilometers up, roughly 60 miles, just over 60 miles up. And, yeah, he's working on his spaceship, too. The first one, 4 years ago, they were testing, and the pilot made it, the co-pilot didn't make it, and, you know, the thing blew up as they were testing it. So they built the second one. Much improved, and right now I believe it's out in California, and they've done one flight test with it so far, I believe. So they're going to be dropping this thing. They call it the White Knight, or White Knight 2 now. They bring it up on this carrier plane, and they drop it, and it comes back and lands. Eventually, the rockets will fire, and you'll be able to put up to six people into suborbital flight and come back and land on the runway. So that's the deal, $200,000 for that. He got rid of his competition. Let me drop it. A company called X-Core. I mean, they're not out of business, but they're going to be they've shifted their business to working on some kind of a rocket for NASA. But this company, X-Core, had plans on sending just one person up and a pilot. And, you know, you sat behind the pilot, and then, wait, I don't know if it was, I think you sat next to the pilot. But nevertheless, it was called the Lynx. LYNX, and Lynx was going to take you up the same common line and come back directly from a runway without a carrier plane. You take off from the runway, go to space, and then come back down. But that project canceled. You know, they have financial problems, I guess, and they're spending more of their time on developing the rocket engine. Lynx is gone, so that means Branson is by himself, unless Blue Origin gets going. Now, toward the end of the year, they should have test people in that thing. Let me drop it. Called the New Shepard. That's the one that's flown five times and came back five times successfully. Unmanned, of course. Toward the end of this year, should have a pilot and co-pilot in that thing. I'm going to guess November. And then as of 2018, plans on putting passengers in at them. You launch from a launch complex in Texas, go up to the common line, and come back. I don't know what that one's going to cost. I haven't heard a price yet. Get to RIWWS
tomorrow. Is there someone else who has a question or a comment? I think space is here to stay, Paul. Boy, you got more and more people getting into it. Are you as surprised as I am the number of private organizations in the United States that are building space hardware? When they canceled the shuttle, for there to be one more commercial organization taking over that, we sort of accepted that. But now you've got quite a slew of them. Were you at all surprised by the number of private agencies that came out of the woodwork? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, you know, a lot of people say that during the early Obama administration, things changed. He was pushing the commercial end of it. And you had Armstrong and some people make speeches that, no, we need to concentrate. Just, you know, they really wanted NASA. They wanted the government to do it. Too big to do privately. You know, it was a big belief. But look, I mean, it's really taken off. You now you've got Sierra Nevada Corporation, Sierra SNC. They've developed the Dream Chaser. They now have a contract with NASA to bring up supplies to the space station starting in 2019, and then after that, and then they're going to be developing their cargo vehicle, eventually dwarf into a crewed vehicle. It's a relatively small looking shuttle, and it's been under development probably 12, 13 years. And, you know, that's going to be really something. I mean, that's going to carry up more cargo than all of the other ones. You know, 12, 13,000 pounds at a time. And then land on a runway. And reusable. So that's coming down the road. I mean, I expect to see that flying within 2 years from Cape Canaveral back to there.
You said land on a runway. You didn't say land on a launch pad. Land on a runway. Does that mean it has wings, Paul?
Yes, Dream Chaser has wings. The wings fold up to get inside an Atlas V rocket. An Atlas V rocket. You have, they're actually going to use the 4 meter fairing. Diameter. So to fold it up, put it inside the Atlas V, launch it with two solid boosters attached to it, and it'll go to the International Space Station. Dock with it or berth with it. It'll have the capability of doing both. Unload everything. Put as much stuff as you want back into it. Anything that you want to burn up, you put into its trunk. Thousands of pounds of stuff. It'll separate from the space station on the way back to Earth. This trunk will separate, burn up. The trunk part will burn up in the atmosphere. We didn't need that garbage anyway. All the science material, spacesuits, and whatever's coming back will be inside the Dream Chaser. It will be able to land in any runway that will accept it. They've already got the acceptance from Midland, Texas, to land this thing if they want to land there. But any international runway would have the capability of landing this thing. It doesn't have the toxic fumes for fuel. Hydroxide types of fuels, hydrazine and all that. You don't have that in the Dream Chaser. So you remember when the shuttle used to come back, you see people with they look like spacesuits, hazmat suits on it. Going up to the shuttle when it first landed, that's because the vapor's coming off from the fuels. You don't have that with the Dream Chaser. By the way, the X-37B, that should be coming back soon. That's been up for almost 2 years now. That looks like a Dream Chaser. You know, it's got wings and everything. That's unmanned. That should be coming back. That's a military vehicle. That's up there now. So, there you go. You're going to have half a dozen different things going up to the space station. And then after the space station's gone, these things will be able to go to a commercial space station called the Bigelow. Bigelow is building inflatable modules that he wants to put together. Maybe we'll have another private space station up there.
How serious is he about building another space station independent of the International Space Station? Is that likely to really go forward, Paul?
I would bet on it. But, you know, it's he's already got the one attached to the space station called the Beam, D-E-A-M. The Bigelow. Exploration activity module. Expandable activity module. So he's got attached to the space station. They'll probably leave it attached for at least another year. And then they'll just disconnect it, deorbit it, burn it up in the atmosphere. You know, he's got plans he's already signed up with Atlas, the United Launch Alliance, to launch a big one, to the space station. If NASA approves it, he's going to dock with the space station. If NASA doesn't approve it, he plans on making his own, and you could put like two of these things together if you want. Docking collars on it, and he definitely has plans for it. And that would be each one of these things would be able to handle a half a dozen people in it, just like the space station. That's his long-term plan, and he's building this stuff right now in Nevada. His location down near Las Vegas.
ROR. You've got it, Joe.
Either Paul or Dick, how much has the space station cost so far with all the attachments that are on it? That's one part of the question. The second part is, what is its life expectancy?
You got it, Paul.
When it was planned initially in the 1990s, 2015 has come and gone, so it should have deorbited by now. Right now, plans, you're paid up until 2024. United States is on board, Russia's on board, and European Space Agency, they all signed up just in the last year or so for 2024. And then now, they're going to push for 2028, but we don't know what's going to happen if they decide to change their mind about that. Russia's thinking about disconnecting a couple of the modules and floating it away and sending up another module or two for themselves and creating their own space station. So who knows what could happen in the future. But we're good till 2024, back.
And a rough guess as to how many dollars have been put into it so far, Paul?
$100 billion, I believe it was. I think they're up to just over that. Sounds like a lot of money. That's what it costs. You've been shooting things up there since, 1998 it started. And they're not done yet. You know, they got a spacewalk coming up. Three spacewalks within the next couple of weeks. They need to relocate PMA-3, pressure mating adapter 3. They got to take that off the Harmony node, the module. They're going to take it off Tranquility node. It's on the port side, and they're going to relocate it to the Harmony node on the Zenith port. So then they'll have two ports. They'll be able to dock two commercial vehicles, like a Dragon, two Dragons, or a Dragon and a Starliner by Boeing at the same time. So, you'll have another space. That space, they plan on putting another docking set up. Place to launch satellites from, similar to what's in the Kaibo module, the bigger. Russians still plan on bringing up a big, huge module, and that will probably happen in 2018, the MLM. It's, you know, it's about 30 feet in diameter and about 30 feet long. So they're not done. But $100 million, $100 billion will change probably. Back in.
Paul, of the $100 billion that has been put into the international
repeater, timeout.
Of the $100 billion that has been put into the International Space Station so far, what percentage of that is United States? What percentage is Russia? What percentage is the European Space Agency? I suspect very little of the cash was Russia, although Russia built some of the modules that are up there. Over to you, Paul, KQIW.
Built by Algorand.
That was built by the Russians. The whole back end of it, it says the functioning cargo block, Pyrrhus, the Razbet, these are all modules that attach to the Russian side. European Space Agency and the United States, we've got Destiny, Unity, Tranquility, Harmony, the Quest Lab, another module to do EVAs from. Then the European Space Agency has put up the Columbus module, gigantic module, you know, probably 30 feet long, 14 feet diameter. Same thing with the Japan. They put two modules up there. Japan actually has the biggest module, probably about 38 feet long, 14 feet diameter, with another one sticking out of the top and another big porch sticking out of that. So that's why this thing is so big. So money wise, I don't know. I don't know the percentage thing. I really don't know. If you go by the pieces that are actually attached, it looks like we've probably paid for the most of it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Would it be safe to guess that we financed at least 80% of it, Paul? What do you think?
I'd say 70%. I don't know if it's 80. I'll go from 60 to 70. You know, the European Space Agency poured a lot of money into it. So the Russians. Look at all the fights that they, you know, they're the ones taking people up all the time, you know. And you know what it costs for every pound of weight to get into space. What if we say $10,000 a pound or something? They've been doing it for decades, you know. It's unbelievable. So, you know, they, whether it's money or physically bringing stuff up or building modules, quite an accomplishment by all these countries on Earth.
Russia is building this super big new module. Where in the world is that going to attach, Paul?
Oh, okay. They're going to disconnect the... they already did. I think they disconnected the Pyrrhus docking. It's actually a smaller module. That's going to... You know, that's going to leave a port open for that. You know, the back end of the space station near one of their nodes, you know, where they connect to. So that's another one of these, what, 14-foot diameter, 30-foot things. MLM, let's call them Multi-Logistics Module, MLM, was supposed to be up there probably 10 years ago. Nothing but delays and problems. You know, building this thing, all kinds of corruption went on, they said. Different people that got involved. And eventually they'll probably get it up there. And one
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Have at least three people on every flight. And then we'll have four. And then you'll have a crew of seven on a regular basis.
What does the MLM give us that they don't already have, Paul, other than a lot more space?
supposed to have a, it's supposed to be a lab. It's similar to what we have at the Destiny module. Destiny module is our main module. We have our laboratory and racks of science experiments. I think there's something like 400 science experiments going on at a time. So they'll have the same thing on their end. They have places where they're doing science, on the Russian side, but nothing compared to what we have. Well, because they never really got their main science lab up there. They do testing in the Zesda module. It's their main big module. But that is also where two of the people sleep. They bring three up at a time. One of the people always has to sleep over in the American side on the Unity location. So there's like four bedrooms over there compared to their two. So that with this new module, they'll have another bed coming up with them. Another bathroom as well. Back to that.
At one time, they were getting some failures, Paul, of the main rotary joint on the solar panels, where it has to have beautiful set of bearings, be very strong, allow it to rotate, I think it's once per orbit, and it's got to have some kind of slip rings in there to transmit all the power through it. And they were getting some kind of a galling, a failure or whatever. Has that been thoroughly replaced, repaired or whatever? Are all the rotary joints on the solar panels in good shape, to your knowledge? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, they've all been re-greased and everything, whatever they use on some of the flights over the years. I know they just did an inspection on one of the last EPAs. They took camera and took close-up pictures. Apparently that's okay. That's next EPA, they're getting ready to bring that pressure mating adapter over. So they'll be doing three EVAs over the next, I guess, 3 weeks. They're going to have a news conference on it this Wednesday. That I got to see. But I haven't heard any problems with the rotating joints lately. They are going to re-grease and rework the end effector on the robotic arm. They've done that before. Do that again. They never thought the robotic arm was going to be working all these years. So there's battery swaps they're going to be doing again. But on these EVAs that are coming up, they're really going to concentrate on moving this pressure mating adapter to the front of the space station onto Tranquility onto Harmony. Just like sitting at Tranquility unused, couldn't use it where it is anyway, and they're going to put it on the top part, the zenith part of Harmony. This is where they'll have sticking out of this one module of Harmony front facing port, which is the one that they use now for the Dragon and Boeing when they come up. They'll have another one coming out of the zenith port. Be able to have two at one time.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You have two. You got two crew vehicles and two cargo vehicles. There's two berthing ports right now for cargo vehicles.
As they add more and more modules, the space station is getting heavier and heavier. Therefore, the amount of mass that you're boosting when you do all of these individual boosts to keep it up to altitude, and I think you do that a few times per year, it's going to take more and more thrust capability as it gets heavier. Has anyone worried about what the future of that is, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
I guess not. You know, they keep doing that. Each time a progress ship comes up by the Russians, they buy the engine, try to gain 8 to 10 miles or so up. I've heard up to 14 miles, I guess, depending on the fuel that they have. And then at the same time, they refuel the space station on the Zesda end of it. the load tanks. And then if they need either to get out of the way in case there's something coming, they have that capability. There's another company. I can't think of the name of that one. He's an ex-astronaut. His last name is Chio. He's got a company. He's building a Vassimer engine. They call it a Vassimer rocket engine. He'd like to attach it to the space station. So it's one of these ion type of engines. And he'll be able to keep that thrust going for as long as he wants. And it takes a lot of electrical power, but they have plenty of power up there on those electrical solar panels. But if you get the Vassimer engine variable, I'm trying to think what it stands for, variable, I can't remember. But it's supposed to be a lot more powerful than your typical ion engine that they put on the spacecraft. And that should be able to keep the space station high enough forever, even without, any kind of refueling.
Yeah, this sounds awfully good. Is an ion-like engine facility going to be put onto the space station so they can take those zillions of kilowatts coming out of the solar panel, apply it to the ion engine? The ion engine can therefore do the boosting, and they're no longer dependent on the Progress missions to do the boosting. Are they moving in that direction? Is that what I'm hearing, Paul? That sounds like a beautiful idea. And when was that one invented, K2RIW?
Ex-astronaut has been working on this for, it's got to be 10 years, I don't know how time gets away, but his location is down in Costa Rica. That's where his business is. But he's originally from there. And he's got an arrangement with NASA to eventually do this Vassimer engine, VAS. RMIR, I think it is. I'll look it up. I'll let you know what it is either during the week or next week. But he's been testing these engines for years. He's got them running all the time. And NASA gave him a grant. You know how it is. Leo Chio, I think his name is. Hope he's not listening. I know I'm pronouncing this wrong. His name wrong. But he's done countless spacewalks. He's got, like, I don't know how many flights on the space station. Or on, up to space. But he got into this, and we'll see how that goes. I wouldn't be surprised 5 years from now you'll see that.
So if I understand correctly, this Vassimer ionic-like engine, I have the impression from what you're saying, he has tested it on the ground, or he's testing it on the ground. Has any of that hardware been put into space yet? And if not, how soon is that space installation likely to begin? Over to you, Paul.
I don't remember him getting any of that in space. It's not like the regular ion engines. You do need a lot of power. So unless he gets a contract with a satellite, say for a deep space mission, where the thing's going to have a humongous solar panel to fire this thing up. I don't think you'll see that anytime soon, but it'd be great for the space station. Those panels, they have power to spare.
Yeah, right now, what percentage of the potential power coming out of those solar panels on the International Space Station? Are they only using 50% or 70% of the available power at this time, Paul?
Well, probably. I would think they could probably survive on 50% and 60% because they've had problems. They had ammonia leaks. Oh, by the way, one of the EVAs is coming up in the next couple of weeks. They're going to check on a possible ammonia leak. They've had that kind of thing before. But they've had ammonia leaks, and they decided to shut down, T6 or something, which is, the port side, truss all the way at the end, and so they shut that down for months at a time. So that knocked out 75. That only gave them 75% power. I knocked out 25% of the power for the longest period of time. But you know, they never cut back on what they were doing. They're still running all these electrical hungry experiments. Oh, by the way, they're slowly converting over to LED lighting. They're doing away with their fluorescent type of lights that they've had up there. Every flight, I think, goes up and brings more of these LED lights. They look like long bars, about 18 inches long, and they keep putting them in the space station. They can adjust them. They sleep better with them, and you know, you make it bright when you're trying to work. Give it a bluish glow, if, you know, in the morning. And it's reading all about these lights. But the good thing about it is it uses less electricity. And the batteries they're sending up now, you know, they're storing even more electricity. So they're not starved for electrical power. Back in the
Yeah, a number of those EVAs are changing out batteries. When they change out the type of batteries, the ones that they're removing, does that go into the module that burns up on re-entry, Paul? Over to you, K2LIW.
Yeah, the last time they did it, they took out 12 nickel hydrogen batteries, not nickel metal hydride, nickel hydrogen batteries. Each one is huge, I mean, like 700 pounds or something. And they took out 12 of these things, and they replaced them with 6. Because they're putting in lithium ion. They're lighter. They give them equal amount, if not more power, than the 12. Now they have 12 batteries. They took the last cargo vehicle that brought this up was by Japan, the H2 cargo vehicle. Another large vehicle that brings up about 10,000 pounds of stuff. That brought up all these 6 batteries. Battery weighed about 500 pounds. Once they took out, each one weighed around 700 pounds. So they took out 12. They put in 6. Only 9 could fit on the H2 vehicle that was returned and burnt up in the atmosphere. They couldn't even fit all 12. So the other 3 are stuck on the space station for the long term. You know, just sitting there attached to one of the external platforms. I guess eventually they'll try to find a way to get rid of them. They have to do this a number of times. Let me drop it. RYY. This is only the first time out of, I don't know, half a dozen different times that they have to do this. I think it's a total of, let's see, 12, I don't know. It's got to be 48 of these batteries or something. So this is going to go on for quite a few years, rechanging these batteries. I heard you.
You got it, Joe.
It's just a curiosity question, either Paul or Dick. What do you think is the, I guess, minimum size of something they're going to let go into the atmosphere in one of these modules as they're burning up before you get something that's so big that it's not going to burn up in the atmosphere? I mean, if you have some object that's like, you know, 20 by 20 by 20, or bigger than that, like almost the size of one of these modules, you just all of a sudden want to let that module go because at some point in time, you're going to say, okay, without the space station, we're going to get rid of it. You can't, like, let the thing come down all in one shot. Wouldn't they have to get rid of the thing in pieces because I guess after a certain size, you may take a risk of the thing not burning up or put it in the atmosphere and the thing comes down. Probably would come down in the ocean, because we're 3/4 water, but, you know, you never know. Back to you.
Yeah, whether or something can burn up completely when it hits the atmosphere on reentry is a little bit more complicated than just size. It's a mass-to-size ratio and what's the material made out of. If you were bringing a great big chunk of titanium back, I think there's a good chance it'll get hot on the way through the atmosphere, but it'll survive and it's going to hit something. By the same token, you build a module as big as they are, but you build it out of cardboard, something that's very light. Because it's got such a large mass to such a large area to mass ratio, as soon as it starts hitting the atmosphere, it would slow down real fast and wouldn't even create very much heating. So a chunk of cardboard re-entering might come back without even burning up. So whether or not something burns up is kind of complicated. But along these lines, Paul, does the International Space Station fly in such a way that the solar panels, let me drop them, are the solar panels being aligned in such a way that they're edge on to the wind that they're touching? The International Space Station is just touching the top of the atmosphere. And if I wanted to minimize the drag so I can do the least amount of boosting, I'd like to fly the huge area of the internet, of the solar panels, I'd like to fly them edge on as far as the airflow is concerned. Do you think they try to do that over you, Paul, KQRIW?
It's been done to slightly adjust their speed if they wanted to. Let's say they want to get ready for a mission from cargo from Japan, and they need to get a little ahead in their orbit, or a little bit behind it. They will take that time at night when they don't need the solar panels, and they'll go either edge on, or they'll try to base on and take that rarefied atmosphere and actually help them either slow down or accelerate. You know, they have done that. But most of the time, the solar panels rotate with the space station, try to track the sun, and not only that, they call it an alpha turn and then a beta turn. Beta turn is the panels themselves actually turn, in respect to the alpha direction, a 90 degree, turning motion. So they can always look right at the sun, and they say it's around 65% of the time they're usually facing the sun. So the batteries only need to be working roughly 35-40% of the time. But they're constantly being charged and discharged. I think the last batteries were 60,000. Charges and recharges or something like that.
The new batteries are lithium ion, probably because of such a high energy density. In other words, watt hours per pound. But lithium ion has got a nasty failure mechanism where it creates a fire. Because they're on the outside of the space station, if at worst it created a fire, I guess it wouldn't do any damage per se. Have they ever mentioned any words about whether or not the lithium ion batteries are designed in such a way that they can't possibly fail? Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
I try to watch the news conference as much as I can, and that was addressed, and they said that they have straightened that out. Now, technically, how they've done that, there's no concern as far as they're concerned about the batteries that are actually built in Japan. They've eliminated that problem with these batteries. Maybe it's an expensive thing where they can't do it on, for the average consumer. I don't know. But whatever the process is, I have no idea. But they know that will not be a problem on their space station.
When a failed lithium ion on the Earth goes into its failure mode and creates a very nasty fire, I am guessing you're getting oxidation that requires the atmosphere to be mixed into the battery to create all that heat. If that battery is in the vacuum of space, I'll bet you it's not possible to get that kind of a lithium ion battery fire anymore. What do you think, Paul? KQRIW?
Yeah, it sounds right, but whatever that ignition process is, I think it had to do with the growing of some kind of a what's the name for it? They put the charging and discharging. They grow a tendril things, grow from one end to the other end, and eventually you get from the positive to the negative, and the thing shorts out and starts a fire. They must have found a way of doing without that. There's been a lot of development of some kind of special membrane, something made out of plastic or something that cuts back on that. Maybe they've done something like that in there. Modern batteries, they probably go $1 million each, looking at the time's ticking away. Back to you, Dick. WS2M.
sounds like they've essentially solved the problem of the battery's growing whiskers. That's what I think they call them. Whiskers, dendrites, stalactites, and stalagmites.
Right, that's what I was trying to think of.
What word are you trying to think of, Paul?
You said it, dendrites. That's what I was trying to think of. They had a great show on Channel 13, PBS. That's my Bible station.
Okay. PBS had a presentation on the batteries on the International Space Station. What was the name of that program? How long ago, Paul?
It had to do with batteries in general. And they really covered the lithium-ion battery situation. So that was probably about a month or two ago. I don't remember the name of it, but it was definitely probably a Nova show. You know, I watch that all the time. But they really they did a good job of explaining the fire hazard with lithium-ion batteries and how these engineers were correcting it. I think it was this guy Krogh. Probably know him. Tall, thin guy. Ask a lot of questions. Something Prague. And he's pretty funny. He comes out with some funny things, you know. I don't know. I'm sure Eric, if he was on, he would know. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, we've come to the end of our time. This was TechNet number 1643. That was Space Report number 243. Hopefully we'll be back next week, and we'll settle all these issues. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. Back to you for any final comments, Paul. WS2N, K2IW, clear but listening.
Okay, very good. And I know John listens in the background, so if he's out there, KC2WGB, we're still here. We're waiting for you. And 73, anybody want to take over the last minute or two? Got about probably 2 or 3 minutes before the repeater quits. We'll be here next week. This is WS2N, 73.
And 2HVR with a comment.
Dick, do you want to take that?
HVR, go ahead.
Good morning. The show isn't over. Yeah, it was about batteries. And I think they solved the problem by changing the solution between the electrodes. Plus, the other thing about the dendrite that would short across the thing, they developed a way of making like a plastic anode or electrode. But the main problem was the solution was the problem, and they had they showed a play where the guy was actually cutting a battery with a scissor, and the battery was still providing power to LED lights without igniting. And normally, if you stick a nail or you cut into a lithium-ion battery, it would explode. So I think they solved the problem by changing a solution to like a gel that won't ignite. Back to you.
You saw it. That was the show. A great show. Over to you, Dick.
Good information. Thank you, Nicholas.
Yeah, I have Nova on my DVR all the time. Records automatically. Great net, and back to you. Good night, everybody.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL amateur radio repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. WQVL repeater system. Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Net tonight.